Welcome. This is On The Ledge Podcast. I'm Jane Barone. We're talking about Hoyas. What's not to like? Well, a very fine day to you all. And in this week's show, I'm going to be visiting the National Collection of Hoyas in Newcastle, curated by the wonderful Felix Horn. And I answer a question about a languishing lime. Love that, a languishing lime. Alliteration, you just can't beat it. Thanks for joining me this week. It's episode 244. And I do hope this audio is finding you in a reasonable state. Now, if you've listened to On The Ledge for any length of time, you will probably know that I'm quite keen on Hoyas. So no surprises, there are a couple of Hoya episodes coming up in the next few weeks. And the first of those is this episode. I travelled to Newcastle to meet Felix Horn, who holds the National Collection of the Hoya genus here in the UK. What's a national plant collection, you may ask? Well, this is a UK charity that helps to conserve plants by gathering together plants of a particular genus and looking after them. And the people looking after them are a huge range of volunteers who study them, keep great records, and generally keep the flame alive for their plant of choice. And in the case of Felix Horn, that happens to be Hoya. So whether you're a Hoya fan or a Hoya disbeliever, I have a feeling that after listening to Felix, you may want a few of these wonderful epiphytic plants. And if you hear a little bit of noise in the background during the interview, most likely it's one of Felix's two cats, one of whom got very interested in our chat and joined in delightfully. So a little bit of extra action there for you cat lovers.
My name's Felix Horn. I'm the National Collection holder for Hoyas.
We're here in your house, Felix, and I'm feeling the Hoya love here. I mean, how did this come about? I seem to remember seeing the call out from the National Collections people saying, we need somebody for Hoya. Presumably you just were alerted to that and thought, this is for me.
Yeah, pretty much. very naively thought, I could do that. I mean, yeah, so my mum had grown a Hoya, which I'm sure lots of people can relate to, that we'd had growing in our house when I was little, and it flowered all the time and it smelled amazing. And then it's just suddenly stopped flowering and got pushed further and further back in her collection and then kind of forgotten about. And then I think probably just before COVID hit, I had started collecting them myself and kind of like rediscovered them. So when I saw the call go out, she gets the RHS magazine. And when I saw that call go out, I was like, oh, I could do that.
And here we are. I don't know how long ago that was, but you've got a collection of Hoyas that's presumably growing all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot.
One of the things I find fascinating about Hoya is just the diversity of this genus. There are just so many interesting variations on the theme. Of the ones that you've got in this particular room, are there any that are your absolute, like, favourites, you know, you're going to be taking from the house as you, you know, go to your desert island?
I've got a Hoya Sunrise off the top of my head. I can't remember what its parent plants are, but it is a cultivar crossbreed. That one I think is really beautiful just with the... So, like, often when Hoyas have, you know, the visible veins, they're darker than the rest of the leaf, and Sunrise is the other way around. And it has these really beautiful flowers that smell amazing as well. And probably Lacunosa is always a really safe bet. That flowers really profusely and has gorgeous flowers. They're scented flowers as well. But then I think my probably most favourite one in here is also the most pathetic one. That is the one that has most actively been trying to die on me for 3 years, and that is my Hoya Archibaldiana.
Okay.
I got that as a two-leaf cutting, that one of the leaves then died, and then I spent 2 years trying to stop the rest of it from dying. And then this year it finally rewarded me by growing 2 new leaves and a whole bit of stem. And it's not like, so it has a grand total of 3 leaves.
That's the thing. With Hoyas, it's kind of like, it's one of these things where when you hear those stories, people who don't grow Hoyas are like, I mean, why are you getting so excited? But when you've grown Hoyas and you know how that pain.
Yeah. That was the one that I always wanted the most, and I have no idea why. It always really called to me, like, it's fine, it looks fine. But I don't know why, yeah. Just the fact that it just wanted to die so bad, and I stopped it, and it seems to be quite happy now. I'm never going to get flowers from it. I'll be lucky if I get, like, 5 leaves off it. And I've got other flowers, like, other Hoyas in here that are just, like, huge and super prolific. And I feel kind of bad for them. Little pathetic 3-leaf Hoyas out competing all of them.
One of the things you were telling me before I started recording was about growing for the National Collection and how you try to, as far as you can, emulate what listeners' rooms might be like, rather than growing them into a rarefied environment where you're sort of tweaking humidity and stuff. These are in a regular room, and as are the vast majority of your collection. Why is that, that you want to kind of promote that kind of growing?
Well, I mean, I don't know if it's standard for National Collection holders, but I feel like part of what your role is growing plants for the nation, like, that the nation could grow. So one of the things I do is I don't import plants from outside the UK, because that seems to be outside of my remit. But also, what's the point of having all of these plants if I'm the only person that can grow them? You know, and so I've got a few more specialist areas that are, like, quote-unquote ideal settings for a plant to grow in, but I'll also have copies of that plant growing in, say, like, your bathroom or somewhere else, to see if they can grow in normal household conditions, because, you know, it's expensive to do the specialist stuff, and it's something that not a lot of people are going to have access to, and I think that that shouldn't be a barrier for people to enjoy these really amazing plants. They're like, yeah, they should be for everybody.
Yeah, but I think that's a really good point. I mean, you have got an IKEA cabinet here, or some kind of cabinet, kind of his IKEA one. Everyone's got the IKEA one. But, you know, as you say, I mean, it does kind of worry me, especially when you see people getting, I think with Hoyas, I guess, like cacti and like aroids, there's this kind of collector's mentality of like, okay, I've got to tick these off the list, and the only way I can get hold of this is by importing it from, you know, Indonesia or somewhere. Which isn't without its problems, right? I mean,
right, exactly.
I'm concerned about how these are growing in the wild, and the pressure to import or to take them out of the wild. Yet, as your collection shows, there are a lot of species and cultivars that you can get hold of in the UK. Where do you source most of your plants from?
So I'm quite lucky that my local garden centre has really got a much bigger collection of Hoyas than most other places, or I'll source them. I don't know if I'm supposed to say.
You can say, places. You can absolutely say specific right. places, it's cool.
Yeah, so my local garden centre is called Cowles.
The famous Cowles, yeah. Wow.
Everybody says that when I mention it. They're just like family run, they're really nice.
Mm.
So I was really lucky, that's how I managed to get a good enough collection to start off for my application at Plant Heritage. Yeah, so I've been lucky with them. There are some online places that I get them from, but I wouldn't recommend them because they're all the ones that send me half-dead plants. It's like a really, really big problem with Hoyas in the UK, that the garden centres and often the nurseries that supply plants to the UK don't know how to look after the plants.
Mm-hmm.
So you're often getting half-dead ones. But I agree, like, I think it's super important to get ones that are responsibly sourced, and that is really, really hard.
Mm.
I think sometimes, from what I've heard of the Thai nurseries, they do a slightly better job because they breed a lot of their own plants, but they're ones that are already named and described, and like in like Plants of the World Online, for example, they can be really sketchy. So like I've got a Hoya Waiatii, and they're critically endangered in their native habitat, but they're super common.
Yeah, a house they're so now, common, aren't they? So yeah.
They must be, I can't imagine there's not a causal link in that. Obviously, like with Hoyas, once you've got them, you can take cuttings from them so easily that you know, as far as poaching goes, if you know what you're doing, you'd probably only have to do it once or twice, but that's still once or twice too many.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess if there's lots of individuals going out and doing it and it's been, you know, there's the market's there for people who are doing it. It's scary, but I mean, it's great to have these plants proliferating in your home. And as you say, hopefully people will be inspired to give some of these plants a try. If you were telling somebody who's starting out where to start with Hoyas, what would you recommend? Is it the old classic Carnosa that we go for?
Absolutely. I think Hoyas is one of those genera that is, you can't go wrong with it, and all the like super boring old ones are just as nice as all the fancy ones.
It's so true.
Yeah,
so
you don't have to do anything fancy with, like, you know, a Carnosa and a Pupacalyx are bomb-proof, and they are so beautiful. They'll grow all over the place. They'll flower, like, so prolifically, and the flowers smell amazing. And you can get quite a lot of variety within those just two species, anyway. I think the thing that's difficult with Hoyas is that they're all named wrong.
Oh, my gosh.
So you can think that you're going to go buy, oh, I'll just go get... So, like, I've got a Memoria here. I'll just go get one of those. Well, that's also called a Gracilis. And depending on what name they've got in the garden centre, you could pay a tenner for that, or you could pay 40 quid.
Yeah. So and I've never got to with that one, I've never really got to the bottom of what it should have taxonomists reach a decision on this.
That one's quite complicated because Gracilis was described first.
Oh, okay.
But everybody seems to default to Memoria and correct Gracilis. And I don't know why it's that way round.
No.
Whether the I really want to dig into that. I want to see what the original publication for Gracilis was, and if that was a, you know, something that they decided that the Memoria was more robust or something. I don't know.
There's, I mean, again, I'm looking here and I can see some Hoyas here where I know there's confusion. Is it Latifolia outer variegated, or is it, what's the other name for that?
Microphylla. I got them as microphylla. I still haven't got
I think microphylla might be the sort of the one that's in vogue at the minute, but I think that's the problem is, like, if there are loads of, like, Hoya scientists and taxonomists, there must be some, but there's not whole books that you can just go and look at for this information, are there?
There's a couple of scientists in Asia at the minute who are doing a really good job with, like, reclassifying Hoyas. And so the thing that they've realized now is using the flowers to classify them is much better than using the leaves, because there's a lot of variation leaves within just one species. But they've literally only just started doing that work. So at the minute, a lot of names are getting changed, but, you know, people already know them. They're getting, they've been changed over the years. Nurseries are making new ones up to sell, like, very standard Hoyas at very high prices.
Yes.
I mean, the Latifolia macrophylla one, I think from what I can tell, what happened is that two people described one of them at around the same time, but with the same name, but different descriptions.
Right.
So one of them matches, like, Latifolia, for example, and the other one doesn't. But I mean, that's just from what it's so confusing. I really don't know.
That is, though, what I would say in my top three Hoyas. I mean, then again, my top three Hoyas is always changing, but I do really love that outer variegated, or whatever the cultivar name is. It's a really, I think the leaves are absolutely beautiful on it. I found it, once it's got going, that one has been okay for me, but I don't know how you find that one. I know you've got it in the cabinet.
I wouldn't have that one if I didn't have to.
Oh, that's interesting.
I've got a bit of a pet peeve against all of the, like, cream variegated.
Oh, right, layers, yeah.
Because I think they're... I think partly if I could get an unvariegated one in this country, I'd probably just have that one.
That's the interesting thing, as you say. Like, I've never seen a plain green one.
Yeah.
Only ever seen...
You can get them in the States, but you can't get them here.
Yeah.
I know I'm a bit... biased against them.
Well, that's the thing, is that you're absolutely allowed to have your own preferences about these things, but I guess that's what the National Collection does, is sort of force you to kind of say, well, I've got to have this because it's part of the National Collection. Yeah. What do you have to do in terms of what the processes that are involved? Presumably just get as many Hoyas as you can and keep records about them. Is that a very crude summary?
Yeah, I think... the hard thing with Hoyas is you have to become an expert on nomenclature really quickly, just to make sure that you've got what they've said that you've got, which helps with the National Collection because that's kind of what you have to do for that anyway. Basically, the job of a National Collection holder is to try and get a hold of all the cultivars of a specific genus, and just keep them alive for like posterity or for scientific interest. Probably not so much for Hoyas, but for things like vegetables or like other like medicinal plants, it can be really useful. Say if a cultivar goes out of fashion, for somebody to still have it if they later find out that it has like blight tolerance, or you know, can survive in different climates and stuff like that. Because plant growing is like any other fashion, things go in and out of style, and Hoyas are just coming back into style after 30 years just being like your grandma's plant. So so you usually have to get one of every one that you can find, and then have another two copies of it in case anything happens. So, you know, house fills up quite quickly.
Indeed, yeah.
Which
yeah,
I'm not complaining about.
No, no. And these plants have a particular, I guess, architecture, can I say? I guess, I don't know if all Hoyas are epiphytes, but I'm presuming that almost all of them are. How does that affect in terms of, obviously, a lot of the V's are hanging, so you've got them kind of emulating that up in the trees kind of environment, but how does that impact on kind of substrates that you use, and what do you find works?
Again, I've
opened up a can of worms here.
I find it hard to make any general statement about Hoyas because it's such a huge genus. And there are so many different plants from, so basically Hoyas stretch all the way from the Himalayas down to the very tip of Australia, and so they're like a really, really massive range, and there's probably like six or seven major different ways that you can care for different Hoyas. So substrate's another tough one.
Maybe we start, let's just say you've got a bog standard Carnosa, or what was the other one you mentioned as being
Pubicalyx.
Presumably they're so tough that you could just stick them in houseplant compost, just regular from a bag, they'll be fine.
You could put cuttings in a houseplant compost and they'd grow, like you could put them in anything, I'm sure.
Yeah, I think I have seen some big old, you know, Nana's Hoya kind of thing where it's like in a garden soil in a pot, you know, it's that kind of like, we're not going to buy compost for this.
No. Yeah, I think those two you can put in them pretty much anything you want. Once you get past them, I generally use bark compost. So then you can get that usually kind of cheaper than normal compost with a mix of orchid bark and perlite. Although I am starting to experiment with using cork instead of orchid bark. And that I find generally uses for like wicks for most of them. Often when you get them from nurseries, they'll be in all sorts of different substrates.
So
I've got one in here that you can see is really miserable, which came in like a...
Yes, I've like had them in that. It's stuck in something. That. I know what you mean. I know exactly what you're talking about. It's like it's in a stump of wood or something.
Yeah.
But I don't know if it is, like, whether it's coconut or whether it's...
Yeah, that's what like, I've been actually...
I had something exactly the same, and it did really badly, and I eventually just took cuttings of it and abandoned the whatever it was. It's really strange, isn't it?
I've really struggled with all of the ones that I've got that are in that did well in their first year, and then as soon as they got out of that and into any kind of stage of maturity, they really struggled.
From what you're saying, I think that flags up for me that it is important when you get a Hoya to like have a... do a bit of research and find out whether it's one of those kind of Himalaya high altitude kind of Hoyas, or whether it's something growing in a much lower altitude and might need less water, because that seems to be quite a key point. And I'm trying to think of some of the ones that I can think of that are kind of more high altitude. I'm thinking of things like Hoya pollinura, which I know I've seen somewhere.
I've got pollinura, retusa, and linearis on the kitchen because it's unheated in there.
Right.
And they're all the like Himalayan ones. So they're like a big temperature variation between night and day. And that's the thing that really gets them to flower and be super happy.
I really like those three, particularly pollinura and linearis. I just think they're such good plants. I mean, you look at Polyneuron linearis, you know, you've got those fish, I think they call it the fishtail hoya, don't they? Those amazing leaves of the Polyneura compared to, I always think the linearis leaves look a bit like green beans or something. They're so different, like just so, so different, such different plants. We haven't really talked about the flowers yet, though, which are, for some people, like the stars of the show.
Yeah, I don't understand people who buy plants just for the, you know, 1 month a year that they flower. Mm. I think it's a good bonus. Like, obviously, I love all the flowers on my plants, but the foliage, like, if you're not going to enjoy it the rest of the year, then...
But I guess maybe it's like though goes back to when people like had massive collections and they could just like bring the flowering things up to be enjoyed. And then I don't know, but who lives like that anymore, right? It's
I wish I could.
I know, it'd be so cool, wouldn't it? It would be so cool. But I mean, the flowers are great. And what I love about them, I think one of the first houseplants I had as an adult was Hoya carnosa. And I remember when it flowered, just like looking at these weird pink fuzzy flowers and going, that is so cool. That's amazing. I do think the flowers are kind of otherworldly of Hoyas.
They just look like little stars, don't they?
Yeah, they're so cool.
Little
shing
stars. They're so cute.
And now, the other thing I must mention when we come talking about flowers is I'm one of those weird people who licks Hoya flowers. I enjoy the nectar.
I do that too.
Do you do that too?
Yeah.
Okay, good. I feel relieved because sometimes people look at you like, okay, that's really weird. But I mean, it's just sugar basically, isn't it?
More from Felix shortly, but now it's time to hear from our sponsors. This week's show is supported by Cozy Earth, the premium bedding company that helps you get the deep, restorative sleep you need. Bedtime is literally my favourite time of day, so it's really important that my bed is the most comfortable place it can be. I got to try out a set of Cozy Earth sheets, and they really are so comfortable. Cozy Earth's high-quality bedding is responsibly sourced and made from soft and sustainable viscose that comes from bamboo fabrics. Bundle up in Cozy Earth pyjamas made from ultra-soft viscose from bamboo this holiday season. Now available in holiday hues. Want to give the gift of a good night's rest with Cozy Earth? On the Ledge listeners can take up Cozy Earth's exclusive offer today. Get 40% off site-wide at CozyEarth.com using code LEDGE. That's CozyEarth, CozyEarth.com and use code LEDGE, LEDGE for 40% off now. And now back to my chat with Felix, and I wanted to find out how many Hoyas there actually are, both in cultivation and in the wild.
When I started collecting, there were like 10 that you could get. And then in the 2 years since I've had my national collection, now there's about 30, 40.
Wow, yeah.
And that's still probably less than a quarter of what ones you can get in cultivation in the world. And probably about 1% of all the Hoyas that are out there. So
what? Really?
Yeah. There's somewhere, people speculate it's somewhere between 2,000 and 4,000 different kinds of Hoya species.
Wow.
And that's just in the
amazing.
Wild. That's not even cultivars.
That's amazing.
So, yeah.
That is really...
That's why I always say I'm not an expert.
But I think the thing is, one of these things that's great about national collections is, you know, you're not portraying yourself as an expert. You've got a lot of Hoyas here and you're obviously very good at looking after them. Like all of us, things go wrong and it doesn't always work. But, you know, that's inspirational. If you were kind of like everything worked and everything was like going great guns, then we wouldn't be able to relate.
Oh, only liars live in a perfect world.
No, indeed. But yeah, I mean, I think they are a fantastic genus. I just hope that we can enjoy them without wrecking the places that they come from. That's my worry.
That's my worry too. I think the thing is with the house plant boom at the minute, Hoyas are a really, really easy one for people to like capitalize on because it's so hard to name them and a lot of them look really similar to each other. So you could sell, like I did that when I first started collecting, I bought what I thought was a really rare Hoya and it just turned out to be a Papakarlix. And I've spent probably 50 times what I should have spent on it.
It's crazy, isn't it?
And people do a lot of things like So the big one at the minute is a Hoya Wilbur Graves that people keep trying to sell for loads of money.
Yes.
And it's just because, so a Hoya Wilbur Graves is descended from one specific plant. So if you can't prove that it is descended from that one specific plant, then it's not a Wilbur Graves, but that specific plant was a type of Carnosa.
Yeah, it's a Carnosa cultivar, isn't it?
It's the easiest thing to
think. I mean, yeah, that's the interesting thing, isn't it? Like, one plant had a particular little spore and produced more. I mean, this whole splash thing, people are mad for this kind of silver variegation.
It's because they don't understand that all Hoyas do that. So yeah. I've got my pollinator through there is a bog standard pollinator, mm-hmm. but two of the branches on it have decided to put on some splash variegation.
Yeah.
If I was so inclined, I could cut those off, root them, and sell them for like 100 quid each.
Yeah.
And I spent, you know, less than half that for that entire plant. So it's so easy to fake things. It's so easy to scam people. I would generally recommend not buying cuttings until you're really, really confident that you can keep them alive, even if they're in the worst condition you can imagine mm-hmm. when you get them. Because a lot of people don't let them root for long enough before mm-hmm. they sell them on. And mm-hmm. I usually, when I take cuttings, I'll leave them for like 6 months to a year mm-hmm. in whatever, you know, like Laker or whatever. I use Laker, but I know that people use, is it Pon?
Yeah, well. Yeah. I mean, I like Laker. One of the reasons why I like Laker for all kinds of things is just because it's really easy to clean it. And whereas with Pon, it's like it's so fine that it's a pain. Done, isn't it? Whereas that, it's much, much easier. Like, even if it's had, like, you know, where it's gone disastrously wrong and it's all covered in algae, you can just clean it up fairly easily and rinse it off and it's good to go. And you can reuse it over and over again, which I think is good from a sustainability point of view. And Hoyas seem to really enjoy it.
The thing is with Hoyas, people spend so much money on them, and I kind of have to because I've got to get the plant for the collection. But in general, I would recommend not spending any more than 30 quid on a fully grown plant for mm-hmm. Hoyas, and like, just unless you're really, really into them, don't go for the rare cuttings. They're just really not worth it when the rest of the genus is so nice.
I wholeheartedly agree. I mean, it's fun to, like, I mean, I bought you a cutting today, you've got a cutting for me. That I love that kind of thing where you're just, you know, and it's kind of like, if you tell me in 2 months' time that cutting didn't do anything, Jane, it's dead, I'm not going to be like, I'm just going to be like, oh, well, you know, if you've not paid any money, that's part of the fun for me. But it's kind of high stakes when people are paying a lot of money for like a two-leaf cutting. And
I think the thing with any interest that a person has, that, you know, you do it because you love it, but also it's a really good way of getting to know people. Like, you know, community is a thing that we're mm-hmm. desperately trying to rehabilitate at the minute, and actually something like this can really give you an opportunity to go and meet other people. And that's the best, like you're saying, you know, take each other cuttings, swap plants, like, that is just a really wonderful thing to be able to do with something that you're enjoying. So
absolutely,
I don't see the point when they're so easy to propagate. If they're so easy to propagate, why are all these people who are selling it online doing such a rubbish job of it?
Yeah. You know? One of the other things I wanted to ask you about, though, was sort of hanging versus climbing. I mean, a lot of the ones here you've got hanging, do you find any difference in growth when you kind of train them up something, or do you find that doesn't make any difference?
It's been a real plant-by-plant situation. Mm. And again, like, so, you know, with all of the plants, I don't know if I said this before after we started recording, but like, I really think that with any plant, you can grow it the best way if you understand where it comes from in the wild mm. and what its root system looks like.
And I'm loving this attention on roots because this is so underrated, isn't it? And so when you have done your Hoya dissections, what are you looking at when you're looking at the roots? What are you looking for, and what is that telling you?
Well, so of the most... Come on, kiddo. the most common thing that problem that Hoyas has is overwatering, mm-hmm. and those roots are really easy to tell the problem because they become very stringy and the outer layer of the root comes off really easily. And so then you can tell maybe you're being overwatered or maybe you're in the wrong substrate, mm-hmm. and wrong substrate is such a common problem with Hoyas. So I think back to what you're asking about whether they're trailing or climbing, that depends so much more on the root of that individual plant, how that individual plant is growing than anything else. So I really do have to take it on a case-by-case basis. But like just so in here, I've got my Lacunosa there, which is super happy. I have two Lacunosa cuttings in my cabinet, which I have had for 2 years longer than I had that entire plant.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you can see the one down there.
Yeah.
It is like, I think I've managed to get 7 leaves on it now. But because when I bought those cuttings, the root system was in a really bad shape and it takes years to recover from that. So when you buy your Hoya from the garden center or the nursery or wherever, there's several different soils that it could be in. Like we've seen with that one, it could be inside a little bark, like an actual tree bark.
A bark tomb.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very strange.
Or it could be in, how did you pronounce it before?
Quia. I don't know if that's just how I say it. Quia.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Quia.
Quia sounds very weird.
Yeah, yeah.
Very
so I'll just say quia. So you can buy it in quia. And I've only recently started seeing quias being put in quia. And so far they look all right. But I don't know if I'll have a different opinion in a year's time.
When you say quia, are you talking about the big chunks as opposed to like, you know, the like very fine?
Fibrous.
Because I've had it before where it's in like chunky coconut
I've seen
pieces.
That before too, yeah.
My the Kerii that I killed was in that.
My sigillatus is in that. And it has been all right.
Yeah. I mean, I took it out. Maybe I've made a mistake by thinking I can't cope with this substrate because I don't understand it. So I repotted it and it died.
I think that, so I repot probably about 60% of all Hoyas that I buy because they're either in the wrong substrate or they're in the wrong size pot. So a lot of things that garden centers and nurseries, to be honest, I think it's probably nurseries do to be able to charge more money for a plant is put it in a bigger pot than it needs.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll grow it in it. So like I'll show you here, my Densifolia is in this tiny, tiny little pot here.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And look how much plant has grown out of that. And it can stay in there for another year or probably.
Densifolia, I've never seen, I wouldn't know that even as being a Hoya. I've not come across that one before.
Yeah, I was lucky getting that one. But again, I'm totally prepared to look it up in a year's time and realise it's a completely different plant.
Something else.
Yeah, so that's in a really small pot and Hoyas need to be like pot bound. They really enjoy it. So because they're epiphytes, what they do, you find your place to root in the tree. And if you can keep anchoring yourself in there, you're just going to keep doing it.
Mm.
You put out the leaves with your aerial roots when you haven't got as strong a hold on it.
Right.
So if you think about it, like if something's quite root bound, they'll put out those anchoring roots. And that means more branches. It means more flowers growing off that because they've got more space for the peduncles to grow.
Mm-hmm.
So like if you want your Hoya to grow, let it be in a little pot. So often when you get it back from a garden center, take it out of the pot, look at where the roots actually go, and then repot it in a pot that's the size for those roots, because you'll often find like centimeters and centimeters of just empty soil around it. And I understand why they do it, because a bigger pot looks like a bigger plant. But then again, you've got to make sure that you're getting the right humidity for your Hoya if you're like letting it get nutrients out of aerial roots, so which means misting. The Hoyas, mostly you want to water them just when they need it, but mist them quite liberally.
Again, as epiphytes, I guess they're experiencing moist air. I don't know, I guess if they're in the Himalaya at higher altitudes, they're also it's kind of fog is probably not the right word, but you know what I mean, it's a moist air environment.
Most of them grow in rainforest conditions, whether that's tropical rainforest or like mountain rainforests. The ones that do the best in this country are the ones that come from like Australia. Echinosa comes from Australia. Australis does, but we've got our own problems with Australis.
Yeah, the weirdness of Australis. That's definitely,
I guess my main message is Hoyas are fantastic, but nobody knows how to grow them, so they're probably going to be crap. So just go with the really boring ones, because at least everybody's selling them to you. You'll know how to grow them.
Thanks so much to Felix for that Hoya realness ending the interview. And if you're a Patreon subscriber, you can hear an extra chunk of interview that'll be coming out in the next few days. And as ever, do check the show notes for some photographs of the flowers on some of Felix's collection and also a fantastic PDF download of Felix's Care Guide for Hoyas, which is really required reading. Plus details of how to find out more about the Hoya National Collection and indeed national collections more widely. Now it's time for Question of the Week. And you remember I mentioned at the top of the show we were dealing with a languishing lime. I just can't stop saying it. I want a languishing lime. Well, I want a lime, not a languishing one. Quite frankly, the talk of lime is putting me in need of a gin and tonic. But let's plough on. Ruth got in touch about a lime plant that was given to her by her son last Christmas, but unfortunately it is languishing. What does that actually mean in a horticultural context, Jane? You may be asking. Well, in Ruth's case, it means that it's dropping leaves at an alarming rate. So Ruth was worried that it had been overwatered after being brought indoors for the winter. Ruth made the sensible choice of hoiking it out of its pot, cleaning it up and putting it back with new compost. Good choice, Ruth. I'm hoping you used citrus compost, but if not, don't worry too much. But ideally, there is a good argument to use specialist citrus compost for things like lemons and limes. Peat-free, natch, if you can. They do have quite specific nutrient needs and also they need well-drained soil. So it's a good choice if you have a citrus plant that needs repotting. Anyway, back to Ruth's problem. The leaves are still dropping despite the changes that Ruth has made. And Ruth wants to know what's going on. Well, I think that citrus are a bit of a problem in a house where all the rooms are centrally heated. Now, maybe not so much this winter in our fuel crisis where everyone's turning off the heating, but in a normal winter where it might be anything around 18, 19, 20 degrees centigrade, that's around sort of 63, 64, 65 Fahrenheit, citrus will often be a little bit unhappy, particularly if the air is a bit on the dry side, because they really desire a cooler temperature over the winter. Limes can get down to about 10 degrees centigrade at night. That's 50 Fahrenheit. And so they do best in a really well-lit, bright room, but one that is that bit cooler. So either the thermostat's set maybe around nearer sort of 12 to 14 degrees centigrade, around sort of 56, 57 Fahrenheit. That way, that tickles their sort of sweet spot of the temperature they like and tends to mean that the plants don't go into this state of, I'm stressed, I'm unhappy, I'm going to drop all my leaves. Even if you're boosting humidity as Ruth is doing, Ruth's saying the temperature generally is 16 to 19 centigrade when the heating's on. I think that's probably a little bit too high, Ruth, particularly if combined with not enough light, because then you have the problem that the plant isn't actually ticking over very fast in terms of photosynthesis, is not drawing up much water, therefore that water sitting around and causing problems. The plant gets stressed and that means it's a magnet also for pests. Things like red spider mite love, absolutely love, citrus. Same with things like mealybugs. So I would also give your plants a really good check over for any pests. And if you can, move it to a cooler, lighter room, Ruth. I know maybe that's an impossibility. I don't know. I don't want to sort of prematurely condemn your lime to death, but I am worried that if you don't have a cooler room, it might not make it through the winter. I do respect you though, Ruth, because you did say that the two marble-sized limes that dropped have ended up in a G&T, which is really the only way to enjoy lime, or maybe on some jerk chicken. Now, you did suggest that if you can't halt its decline, that you should uninvite your son for Christmas so he doesn't see it. Oh, it's a tricky one. I don't know what to suggest. I don't wish to be at the centre of a domestic drama this Christmas. I no doubt have enough of that from my own family. But I would suggest that if you can find somewhere that might work with those lighter conditions and lower temperatures, maybe you can pull it back in time for the festive season, Ruth. Just as I say, check those leaves really carefully for pests, keep an eye on those roots, and hopefully you'll find that it's all looking more positive for Christmas time and you'll get some new leaves and shoots. If you've got a question for On The Ledge, drop me a line on theledgepodcast@gmail.com. And that is all for this week's show. I will be back next Friday. Make sure your NPK balance is correct, which of course stands for Nature, Plants and Kindness. Bye! The music you heard in this episode was Roll Jordan Roll by The Joy Drops, The Road We Used to Travel When We Were Young by Komiku, and Whistle by Benjamin Banger. The ad music was Holiday Gift by Kai Engel. All tracks are licensed under Creative Commons. Visit the show notes for details. Thank you.